Great. Okay, so welcome to the Sunday night There is a Solution newcomer and returning members meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. Visit our website at oaontario.org where you'll find the
Oh, shit.
You just got muted, Lynn.
Yep, Lynn, you're muted. Lynn, you're still muted.
Is it okay now? Thank you. This is a night, I'm telling you. The opinions expressed are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. Our speaker today is a compulsive overeater and a member who has at least, I want to say, 28 years of abstinence, but I really can't remember. Yeah, that's it. Okay. Has recovered through the directions of the Big Book and maintains recovery on a daily basis. After his share, there will be time to make a comment or ask a question about the OA program or what the speaker has shared. So please help me welcome John Kay, a compulsive overeater from Los Angeles. Good evening, John.
Good evening, Lynn. My name is John Kieran. I'm a recovered compulsive eater, and I'll just give a couple of quick stats to get them out of the way. I've actually been in OA for 42 years. I have 28 years of abstinence and 42 years in another program. And for those who can do basic math, you'll notice I said 42 years and 28 years. And that should tell you there's a reason I spent a lot of time talking about relapse, because I was in relapse for 14 years. And I like to talk about that. I'll tell you something funny. I couldn't do this morning because it was a phone meeting. But a couple of years ago, when I hit 40 years of sobriety, I always get these medallions for my keychain. And they're pictured Bob and Bill, and they have the amount of years in Roman numerals. So I went to get it, and I don't think you can maybe see it up here, but it says XL. And I'm like, oh, if there's something a compulsive eater does not want to see, it's the letters XL. So I thought I'd share that. For anybody who heard Vision for You this morning, I'm sorry, you're going to hear a lot of the same stuff. I'll be and doing some of different stuff because I was on a specific topic. I'll just give you my bio quickly. Because my food log is pretty boring. I ate just like everybody else, and everybody knows how to eat, so I don't think I need to give instructions on that. I'm the child of two different alcoholics who split when I was very young, and I kept going back and forth between the frying pan and the fire. And it was a very crazy, chaotic childhood I had, very traumatic. I told somebody the other day, my brother was 7 years older than me, and he talked about he ended up in the PTSD ward of a hospital. He's 7 years older than me, by the way. He ended up in the PTSD ward of a veterans hospital. And he said, boy, it's interesting. I'm the only one in the PTSD ward who hadn't been in Vietnam. And I said, well, we had our own war. It was just at home. And it really was true. There were crazy, you get crazy things from parents who are alcoholics because, for one thing, they're totally out of touch with their emotions. And so crazy, absolutely crazy stuff would happen. And then the next day, everything's fine. Everything's fine. Pay no attention to the car coming through the front door. Everything's fine, things like that. And we never speak about emotions. We'll tell you whatever you want to know about politics or sports. But boy, talk about emotions? No way. No way. And this is the way I grew up. And the other, to me, the worst thing that was imparted to me was, and this is never said, so many of these things were never said to me. Nobody ever sat me down and said, oh, become an alcoholic. It's really fun. But what happens is, you watch things as a kid. And what I watched was my parents getting upset. And when they got upset, they would say, I need a dot, dot, dot. I need a drink. I need a pill. I need a cigarette. I need a this or that. And what that taught me at an early age, if I didn't like how I'm feeling in here, there's something out there I can put in here to make it better. And for me, at a very early age, that was food. And so I grew up as the fat kid, which is absolutely miserable. I've been a fat kid, I've been a fat adult. Trust me, fat kid is way worse. It was absolutely brutal in terms of abuse, verbally, physically, and I grew up and I didn't want to be like all of us. We didn't want to be heavy, but that's the byproduct of what we do. And so I tried everything. I was in Weight Watchers when I was 13. I tried every diet in the world. And when I first came to OA, I used to say I tried every diet in the world and none of them worked. But the reality is I tried every diet in the world and they all worked once. Because I'm a good little student. Give me the syllabus, I'll follow it and do what you say. But the trouble is, I got a brain of a compulsive eater who, as soon as I start to get that, I start playing games, looking for loopholes. And the next thing you know, it doesn't work anymore. So I was heavy all the way through high school. I didn't go to the prom, I didn't have a date. I hung out with all the other freaks and geeks. And at the end of high school, I found alcohol. Now I know this isn't an AA meeting, but there is a reason I got to talk about it a little. I found alcohol despite my plans to not, because I was gifted with this really good brain, and I can say that because there's nothing I did to deserve it. In fact, my school transcripts are full of the line, "Does not live up to expectations," right? But where's it going to go with that? I wasn't going to be an alcoholic because I had read up about alcoholism, and oh, children who have parents as alcoholics can often become alcoholics or marry an alcoholic. And I'm like, I'm not doing that. But I'm an 18-year-old boy full of hormones, desperately want to meet the other sex, but incredibly, shy. I don't know if anybody remembers The Big Bang, but there was a character who could only talk to women when he was drunk, and that was me. But I fell in love with it because all of a sudden I would drink and my self-hatred went away. I became more confident, and I was sort of a likable drunk. I had a father who, when he got drunk, would want to fight everybody. I had a mother who, when she was drunk, would cry, put on sad songs and cry in her drink. And I was the one who tended to be happy. So that's not a bad thing. So, but the trouble was, you all know how alcohol works. And I will just say that was the first time in my life I was ever able to lose weight. Because essentially, I changed my sugar to the liquid form, which is very close chemically. And the way I lost weight was an interesting thing. I wouldn't eat for a week at a time. I wouldn't eat anything for a week at a time, and then I'd go have a binge one night, and then I'd go back and not, eat for a week at a time again. And if you're an 18, 19-year-old boy and you do that because you got the metabolism of a hummingbird, you will lose weight. It's not a particularly healthy way to do it. But in looking back later with recovery, I realized, God, there was a part of me that knew even then that there was no dimmer switch on this. There was only off and on. And the only way I could maintain any kind of weight was to keep it off as long as humanly possible. And so that's what I did. I did crazy exercise. I would run along the side of the road until they passed out, literally more than once. And so when I hear this is a matter of willpower, I want to go, hey, I can run to like pass out. I have plenty of willpower. But when it comes to this, it's not about willpower. So I got to a normal weight for, I always say, for 10 seconds. I had my first girlfriend, my first relationship. But then, you know what? The alcohol took over. And very soon, I started gaining the weight back. And then I lost the girlfriend, and then I was eating and drinking. I said I went from having a girlfriend named Sharon to a boyfriend named Jack Daniels, and then a threesome with Jack, Ben and Jerry and me. And I got to my highest weight before I got sober. And oh, I didn't mention that either. I was about 110 pounds more than I am now, been that way, and maintained most of that, except during my relapse, for most of my time in program. And so what happened is I ended up in detox on a Christmas week, which is a wonderful time to be in detox. And they took me to meeting AA meetings, and I didn't want anything to do with you folks because you're all a bunch of religious nuts, you know? And so I ended up leaving detox, and I do what you do when you leave detox, you go get drunk. But for whatever reason, I was drawn to coming back. I remember I got drunk on a Saturday night, and I was drawn to come back to this Sunday morning meeting. And I couldn't tell you what happened in the meeting, but at the end of the meeting, we're putting away chairs, and I'm having an argument with this guy who was in program. And I said, I can't be part of this. It's a religious program. And he went, no, this is a spiritual program. And I was like, oh, BS. And I pointed to the steps because they were on the wall. See, look, God, 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 him with a capital H, God. And he looked at it and he looked at me and he said, okay, leave it out. What? He said, leave it out. You can be here till you're 120 years old. Nobody's ever going to tell you you have to believe anything about a higher power or believe anything specific. And then the thing he said that was the key is he said, just one thing, try and keep an open mind. And because he said it that way, it made all the difference in the world. Because I was so mentally nuts at that time and paranoid. You know, I've heard old timers tell newcomers, oh, keep getting, you'll get the God thing. And if I'd have heard that, I'd have been, oh my God, I gotta leave. The cult is gonna get me. You know, the Scientologists are gonna brainwash me. But because he said it that way, it left the ability, you know, it sort of put a little mustard seed in the door. And it allowed me on my own time to find a power greater than myself that could help me with my problem. So I stayed around AA, but then I started going back to the crazy dieting because I wanted to lose all that weight I had gained. And I ended up having a relapse in AA. And when I came back, by then I had heard of OA and I knew I needed to go there. And so I ended up going to OA and all of a sudden, everything made sense. You know, why is it I got this great brain and it's of no use whatsoever when it comes to the food or the alcohol? And again, it's because I couldn't understand I have a disease and I needed power greater than myself to help me. And so I came in, I fell in love with the program. I had the food plan they had at the time, and I lost the weight, and I couldn't understand why you guys have so much problem. This is so easy. God. And what happened is I gave it away. I gave it away because, hey, if it's easy once, it'll be easy again. And it wasn't easy. It was, you know, of no use. And I kept trying to get back. And I kept trying. And I was doing I remember saying one day, and again, I hear things in my head that come out of nowhere that I got to think is some kind of higher power. And I was going, God, I'm doing everything I did the first time and it's not working. And all of a sudden, a little voice said, well, maybe you didn't do it right the first time. And you know what? It was right. Because all I was doing was going to meetings, having fellowship, and having a food plan. And no steps, no big book, no any of that. And I realized that, and I realized I had to do some work. I always say that I realized later in recovery why that crazy way I did it worked the first time. It worked because it was just another one of those diets that worked for me once. I think I have a classic OA story. Come in, get absent, have it work once, and then it doesn't work because you'll get a lot of people get that grace abstinence the first time, you know, and if you got it, hold on to it because I think you only get it once. We got back in the meetings. I was still slipping and sliding, not as much. And then I moved out to LA and my program fell apart. I couldn't string a couple of days, a couple of weeks. I would be absent and then I wasn't, and then I was, and then I wasn't. And I truly believe, when you look in the big book, there's only like I think about five or six times where they use the word relapse. And a goodly amount of those are in like the later ones, like, to the wives and stuff like that. Except right in the beginning, I think the whole begin, I mean, right in the beginning of More About Alcoholism, I think really keys on the stuff about countless vain attempts, right? And so I couldn't get it. I couldn't understand. I'm going to meetings. I'm going to 4 to 5 meetings a week, and I'm a delegate at my intergroup. I'm at these meetings. I have a sponsor, and I was even a sponsor myself in leading meetings, which I shouldn't have done, by the way. And I couldn't get it. Now, I know lots about psychology. I know a lot about philosophy. None of it helped. I was knowledge of our disease alone will not cure us on the hoof. And I always tell the story. I remember leaving the meeting I was running and stopping at the donut shop on the way home. And I remember walking out of that donut shop going, oh, what am I doing? It's not like I'm sentenced to OA. If I don't want to be here, I don't have to be here. But that's that cunning and baffling and, demoralization we have. And I couldn't get it. So let me fast forward. It took a while. I went to another program for a while that had a very structured food plan. And it's what I needed at the time because with my disease, I was so immature that I would look at people and go, well, if she gets to have that, I want to have that. And if he gets to have that, I want to have that. And the reality is, I can eat certain things other people can't. Other people can eat certain things I can't. And this is where this program can be a little harder in terms you have to figure that out. I recommend you do it with a sponsor or with a nutritionist. But for me, I couldn't do that. So I went to the other program that, I was like, oh, well, in AA, everybody does the same thing. I'll go to this program where everybody does the same thing. And you know what? It worked. They gave me what they promised me, which was getting back down to a normal weight. And the thing is I saw it as an authority figure. They would have this sort of mantra: we eat 3 meals a day, nothing in between except diet soda, sugar-free gum, and I forget what else. And I did that, but after a while, I've got this oppositional personality, it stopped working for me. And I came back to OA. And the funny thing is, I heard a guy, he's still around, he's got to be 95, his name's Ray. And Ray would get up at meetings and he'd say, my abstinence today is I eat whatever I want, whenever I want, as much as I want, if I'm willing to pay the price. And today I am not. So I eat 3 weighed and measured meals, nothing in between except diet soda, sugar-free gum. And he says the same thing that they said in that program. But the difference is Ray's working his food plan. He's not working their food plan. And I think it's so important that we take ownership of this. I mentioned it at the meeting earlier, the one word I forbid sponsees to say is the word can't. I can't eat sugar. I can't eat white flour. Sure, you can. I live in the United States. We can go to Costco and buy a 55-gallon drum or a huge cart of anything I want. It has to become, I don't want to do this. I'm tired. I know where this goes. It doesn't ever have a happy ending. And I need to say, for me, I want to do this. It's about for me. I'm the beneficiary. And that's the kind of thing that started to change in me. And I always tell the story because I think it's really important. The change that happened for me had to do with my idea of what powerlessness was. I'd get up at meetings and say, I'm powerless, and then I'd go out and binge again. And I'd come back and say, I'm powerless, and go back and binge again and do that over and over. And I couldn't see it then, but I look and get back and go, well, how powerless did I really think I was? Was I saying, oh, the hell with OA, I'm not coming back? No. What was in there, though I couldn't see it at the time, what was in here was, when I'm done, I will come back and I will get abstinent again. And there's not a lot of powerlessness in that, you know? But why did I think that? Because I had the empirical proof that I could. If anybody has ever lost their absence and gotten it back and lost it and gotten back, you have the empirical proof that you can, quote, get abstinent again. And the reality is, I am powerful over the food, but only in the small picture. In the big picture of life, I'm not. I'm totally powerless. And the problem was that I was on this years-long in and out, in and out, in and out cycle, and I had deluded myself into believing that some of those ins was abstinence, but it really wasn't. And the way I explain it is, I said, imagine I'm a person and I go run 300 yards, and then I sit down and take it easy for a while. And then I get up and I run another 300 yards and take it easy, right? Now I can do that for 26.2 miles, or I can run a marathon. And there is a big difference between those two. And that's the thing for me. Abstinence is a marathon. You know, it means getting through everything life has to throw at us, no matter how shitty it is, and not bailing into the thing we had as a pressure valve. You know, there's a great line. I'm grab my big book and find it, but I won't right now. But it's at the bottom of page 450, the top of page 451, where it says, you know, the tides of life flow endlessly for better or worse. I can't allow my abstinence, they say sobriety, I can't allow my sobriety to be dependent on the ups and downs. You know, it must have a life of its own, which my short-term on that, shorthand on that is, and excuse my language, shit happens. It's always gonna. And if I go to eat, it's not going to get any better. And it just didn't work. So anyway, what I had to do was change my definition of powerlessness to being food can no longer be an option. You know, an option to feeling lousy, being upset, having things go on. It just couldn't be an option because, and I heard a person say it once, that if you're a compulsive eater and food's an option, it's always going to be the only option. It's always going to be the path of least resistance. You know, if you have a choice between feeling lousy or eating a food that A, you like the taste of, and that B, makes you feel better for a little while, well, God, it's almost a no-brainer, right? And so for me, food had to come off of that and quit being an option. And you know, they always say if it's not an option, it's not a problem. And for me, that was one of the big changes I made in looking at how I handle powerlessness today. I still eat and I enjoy my food, may even occasionally eat a little more than I should, but it's none of my red light foods, and I know this. The other thing I didn't really understand was my disease. You know, the way I liken my disease today is I call it like the world's best salesman. You know, if anybody knows a salesman, they're smooth and, you know, suave, and they're likable, and they like their product, and they know you like their product, which is the food. And imagine if you're trying to get out of a relapse, that salesman's there 24/7 trying to make the sale. And the really evil thing is, this is a salesman that can read your mind. Imagine how hard it would be if you walked into it, buy a car, and the salesman could read your mind. Anything you were going to say, well, I don't sure right now, he'd have the answer to. You know, it's like in the big book, the salesman says, oh, you're trying to stay sober. It's okay. You can put whiskey in the milk. It won't bother you, right? But that's what my disease did. And the thing is if the disease made the sale, which meant I ate, which I did many times, he would then put his arm around me and say, oh, and by the way, you know, this was your idea. Yeah, it wasn't my idea. If it was my idea, I wouldn't have been going to 4 to 5 meetings a week. I wouldn't have had a sponsor, wouldn't have been a delegate. But that's the nature of addiction. In that moment of impulse, my disease convinces me it's my idea. And this is one of the things that's really changed in how I look about the disease now. You know, I needed to find a way to make my disease be something from without rather than from within. I need to see it as something attacking me, not as just me changing my mind for the 5,000th time, you know? And it's a hard thing to sort of wrap your head around, you know, because like if we're talking about cancer, well, you know, somebody with cancer, you can put them in MRI and you can see the tumor. But you know what? They are growing that in their own body. Nobody's injecting cancer into them, but we all understand intellectually they don't want that, right? Well, it's harder when you deal with something that's a cognitive disease like we have with addiction. And a parallel to that would be, let's say, epilepsy. You know, people with epilepsy, you can't put them in an MRI and show the epileptic part of the brain. But we know they're epileptic by the symptoms that they have, which is having seizures. But the main difference between those people and us is if an epileptic has a seizure, when it's done, they don't feel guilty about it. Unlike us, right? For me, I had to start to see this is something I don't want. And I can guarantee, I don't usually speak for other people, but I'm going to guarantee everybody who's listening to this right now doesn't want to compulsively eat, or you've got better things to do on a Sunday night than be here, right? But again, in that moment of impulse, it convinces us it's our idea. And so I needed to find a way to see that disease as something outside me that I had to deal with, even though technically it's in my head. And so it involved trying to find a way with my disease to sort of change all that. And I talk sometimes, you know, about how that happens for me. And for me, I always like to say this because especially in a relapse meeting, because I don't think this ever gets said enough. Abstinence in the beginning is hard. You know, we all want to be speakers and be inspirational and all. And I would hear that when I was new, and I'd be going, "What's wrong with me? I'm hanging on by my freaking fingernails." I would have loved if somebody had said, "Hey, you know, in the beginning, it's hard." I tell sponsees all the time, when you're new to abstinence, it can be painful sometimes because you don't lo no longer have the thing that got you through life. You no longer have that pressure valve. So sometimes life can be painful. Sometimes you're going to have to go through life with white knuckle abstinence, you know? And white knuckle abstinence is definitely like the optimum way. But if it's a choice between white knuckle abstinence and eating, take the white knuckle abstinence because it's finite. But a relapse can go on and on and on and on. And I'm a perfect example of that, you know. And I'll just say one other thing. I did another special edition a while back on ego. One of the things that's really changed in me is my ego situation. And, you know, ego is just through the big book, every other thing is about ego,
3 minutes.
self-centeredness. Okay, thanks. And for me, it's the biggest change in terms of how I go through life and how peaceful I am about life. But the key to me with ego can tie directly into the steps in terms of like step 6 and 7. You know, we call them character defects, which I hate that phrase. To me, the word defect has a certain thing connoting. These were defense mechanisms. These were things we came up with to get through life, and they worked, or we wouldn't have kept doing them. But now they're working against us. And I have to get rid of them because I need to break the patterns. You know, the same things that got me in trouble in elementary school were the same things that got me in trouble in work and in relationships and all that. And the basis of all of that, when I kept stripping things away, was fear. You know, I think fear is at the bottom of so many things. And my main fear was fear of not being enough. Not being enough, not being as good as you, not being a good enough man, as not being a whatever, you know. I lead a whole group every week called Reframing the Narrative, and it's all about how much of this societal crap we get that we think, oh, we're not like that. There's something wrong with us. When everybody is the way they are, and it's fine, you know. And for me, I had to change. And I'll just tell you the big revelation I hit about, I don't know, 5 years ago. And it's this: we're all just these little kids running around in these adult suits. And none of us got the manual. You know, the manual on how to do life and figure it out and get along with everybody. And so we spend our lives in a series of trial and error, trial and error. And some of my errors affect you. Some of your errors affect me. And the other thing we do is we look back at all of the errors we made and beat the crap out of ourselves about them, right? Anything we ever did wrong, any decision we think was wrong, which the other thing about those decisions is, we always aggrandize the road not taken. Oh, if only I had done this, things would be different. Well, yeah, they'd be different, but would they be better? I have no way to know. And so the main thing I'm trying to say is, I hit a point where once I accepted that humanness, and I'll wrap up, I know it's going to beep in a second. My favorite paragraph in the big book is on page 417, and it's not the acceptance paragraph, it's the one right after it, where he says, you know, when I criticize me or you, I'm criticizing God's handiwork. I'm saying I know better than God. And I read that for years about me working on my judgmental part so I don't criticize you. But that's not what it says. It says, when I criticize me or you, I'm criticizing God's handiwork. And to me, what that means is, I'm right where I'm supposed to be. I don't want to be. I want to be perfect. But maybe I am where I am for a reason, you know, that I'm meant to be here to learn something, maybe to help other people. And as a result of being the person I am, I realize you're in the place you're supposed to be, and that you didn't get the manual either. And anyway, I know I've gone over it, but these are some of the things that have changed in my life, and none of them would have changed if it hadn't been for AA and OA and the big book and the steps. So thanks for letting me share.
Thank you so much, John, for sharing your experience, strength, and hope with us. Just waiting for the recording to go off.